Hello, hello! Welcome to How to Be a Changemaker. I am so excited to have you here. If you are an organizational leader and have a deep desire to, one, motivate yourself better and to lead yourself with deeper courage, confidence, and conviction, two, empower your employees to be their best, and three, innovate and create a work culture that allows everybody to thrive, you are in the right place. My name is Samantha Clark. I am your host. I'm a happiness consultant and resident change maker here, and I cannot wait to share with you all the gems and amazing goodness in this episode. Take a seat, get ready to enjoy, and tuck in. Hello, hello. Joining me this week, I have Vanessa Johnson Burgess, and she is an HR and employment law expert. And she's also the founder and CEO of Inclusive Recruiting, a disruptive recruitment agency challenging the mindsets and behaviors around recruitment, training, and consultancy. And she's really about how do we bring and embed true inclusion and belonging in the workplace. She's also the founder of A Little Bit of HR, delivering great HR services to SMEs and helping them to support their employees and leaders and managers with more inclusive practices. So we really dive into what does it mean to create more integrity around your inclusion and belonging practices? How do leaders start to have these conscious conversations around inclusion in the workplace? Where have we been going wrong? How do we include the different generational attitudes and interpretations around inclusion and belonging? I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Hello, hello, Vanessa. How are you?
I'm good. It's very well, thank you. Glad the weather's starting to change, even though it might have made me a bit throaty today.
Oh, I know. We've all got a little bit of a tickle, so hopefully we can navigate our throat frogs.
Yes.
The duration of this interview.
Yes.
I wanted to invite you on to really think about your role as a change maker, supporting diversity and inclusion in companies. Would you share with us the work that you do, or maybe even just to go a little bit more abstract, what are three words that describe how you show up in the world and the work that you do?
Oh, I like that. Three words that describe how I show up. I definitely wouldn't have used the word change maker. So you've asked me for three words. I'm telling you what I'm not. I wouldn't have used change maker. So I feel quite honored for you to ask me to join you and talk about this today, because I don't feel like I'm a change maker. Three words that I would describe that show me up in the world are disruptive, mm-hmm. demanding, and funny. I think those are my three. Definitely push the barriers with individuals in a disruptive way. You know, I just think if we don't do things in a different way, we're going to keep getting what we've always got. You know, I always use this phrase, what's your norm is not my norm. And so this mm-hmm. disruption is necessary for me to you know, upturn the norm of what is the norm for those in society, you know, for all of us as individuals. So, yeah, disruptive is my favourite of the three, I would say. But I am known as and do enjoy a huge amount of humour. So I think I would definitely be described as funny and like to feel that I show up in the world as funny. So, yes, those are my two favourites, probably.
I love that. It's funny that you wouldn't describe yourself as a change maker. You know, when I think about so many definitions of what a change maker is, and it's roughly anyone who's taking kind of creative action to solve a social problem.
Ooh.
And I really think that, you know, the work around diversity and inclusion in companies is a deep problem. It's an area that needs more attention. Yeah. Where do you think we need to, well, first and foremost, is it called D&I? Is it DEI? Like, how do you describe the work that you do, and how do we make sure that it does include every spectrum?
That's a big question. Organizations, individuals out there have got many descriptions. Some people call it D&I, diversity and inclusion. Some people call it EDI, equality, diversity and inclusion. Some people call it EDIB, equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging. Some people focus on a JEDI, a fantastic charity for young people's mental health, focus on a JEDI, which is anti-racism, diversity, equity, justice, inclusion. There are many different descriptors for it. And I think my organization and what I do works under all of those remits. But the biggest one for me is equity. And equity is about ensuring that we have a society that pivots and makes changes so that everybody feels like they're starting at the same place and have access to the same thing, right? So we've been talking about equality for the last 10, 15 years. We've created all of the policies and procedures in HR around equality, giving people equal rights to everything. And what individuals now start to realize and establish is that actually equality doesn't work. Equity helps to ensure that those who need a little bit more help are able to access the same thing. So equity is a big one for me, and it's a big area that I focus on. I'd like to think that we can get to justice, and justice is when you don't even need to take equitable steps anymore. Mm-hmm. But until we can get to justice, my fight is around the equitable, equity.
And so how do you support companies and leaders and managers to really think about equity at the heart of what they're doing or the heart of their HR strategy or part of their HR strategy?
I mean, it depends on the organization, right? I either have an organization who is really, all organizations I work with are really engaged. All HR practitioners that I work with are really engaged. But some of them have, you know, a sort of a 0 to 10, how much do you know about the area of work that you're going into? So I work with them in a number of ways. There are some individuals and HR leaders that I work with who just need somebody on side when they're adopting equitable practices into their processes, policies and procedures. You know, so we get to the change where we've all got these great policies and procedures that ensure that we've got equality in our workplace. And HR practitioners now, HR leaders now are saying, actually, it's not enough to have a policy that is just equal. You know, when you're looking at women in the workplace, for example, and any policy that affects a woman in the workplace, you have to consider the intersectional differences of women. So one policy that focuses on women in the workplace, well, how does that woman show up if she is a Muslim woman, a black woman, a disabled woman, a gay woman? What if she is a black, disabled, trans woman? All of these multiple layers of an individual means that the one identity of gender of woman doesn't necessarily mean that one policy that focuses on woman will work. So with a lot of my HR leaders and practitioners, it is sort of guidance and support to navigate, especially where HR practitioners are now being given the responsibility of diversity and inclusion, equity and belonging. They're given this responsibility, and you know, some of them don't necessarily have all of what they need for that. So I'm digressing so much, Sam, but one of the areas is to support them by guidance, support on transitioning their knowledge between HR and EDI where they need it. Another area is hands-on operational, you know, support, where I work with their organizations to gather employee experience to help then take that employee experience and align it to some of those policies and procedures to establish where biases are showing up. Mm-hmm. And another way is to support them in the creation and the writing of their overarching EDI strategies so that it brings that business strategy to life. So yeah, those in a very long-winded way, I feel like I went on, but multiple ways in which we support HR leaders and other leaders to move along the journey of equity in their organizations.
Brilliant. Where do you think there's been a pivot, or can you see that there has been a dramatic pivot since, you know, the course of last year with George Floyd? Do you think that we were sleepwalking with some of our D&I strategies and there's been a dramatic shift in the right direction?
I've got to be honest, right? And I chew the fat over this. Yes, of course, there's been a dramatic shift. It frustrates me that it took the actions of the murder of a man in broad daylight, a black man, that happened to be captured, because that's why we're here, right? Happened to be captured and happened to be done by police officers. It's been done hundreds of times beforehand at the hands of police officers, but it's been captured. And the whole of the world was sat at home and watched it. So my organization's been running for 6 years. We've been talking about this for 6 years. And the murder of George Floyd had a huge impact on bringing this conversation further forward in organization. Whilst I am pleased the conversation is now happening so much more often and is actually turning to action, because what we saw a lot of before the events of May last year, what we saw a lot of was organizations who had some appetite but didn't really take it into action, only did it in the very surface level ways. You know, well, we'd like some more diverse candidates, so can you just help us to find some diverse candidates, for example, in one area of my organization. But none of that matters if you don't have a environment in your organization that makes that candidate come in and stay. You know, diverse candidates would leave within 18 to 24 months, particularly candidates from Black backgrounds. They'd come in, they'd leave between 18 and 24 months because they didn't feel like they belonged and the environment wasn't inclusive. So what we see now is this huge shift where the conversation goes from surface level to action orientation. You know, people are actually trying to implement things and do things. And so there is some joy in seeing that move to action, but some frustration that it took this for that to take place. You know, why do we have to witness trauma? Why do millions of people have to be triggered for this action to take place? These inequities, this racism, structural inequalities and systemic biases have been happening in the workplace for years. Mm-hmm. And have been happening in society for years. Of course, you know, I'm hugely focused on the difference in the workplace, but societally, I can talk to microaggressions and racist behaviors that happened towards me from the moment I knew it was happening, you know, at 6 years old, when someone screamed a name at me and my sister from across the street. So this isn't new, right? But it is what you see in the last year is this distinct shift from surface level. We can just get away with the basics, or let's just focus on gender. That's diversity. And that gender wasn't good enough anyway, because that was only man and woman. But let's move that on now and let's move to action and understand that there is an intersectional reality of lived experience of everyone that needs to be given their identity and need to be looked after for society, not just for the workplace, but for society.
And so how do we create an environment that really does nurture and embrace people from different ethnic origins? And do you see a difference between what maybe the younger generation are willing to accept at work versus, you know, maybe older generations? You know, when we were thinking about last year, and I was having quite a few conversations with friends of mine, and we were saying that, you know, some of the microaggressions we put up with when we were in the world of work before we started our businesses, I don't think the younger generation are putting up with that anymore, or they're vocal about it, or they are moving on quickly. Like you said, they're not staying long. So what can companies do to really assess where the gaps are across the different generations?
I mean, the key for me is representation at all levels. And it's more than just that, right? But at the very least, have representation at all levels within your organization so that you have individuals with lived experience and understanding and knowledge of those individuals, of as many people in your workplace as possible. And when I say representation, I mean full representation of race, religion, sexuality, gender, ability, you know, all aspects of an intersectional perspective. Organizations need to do better to force that. You can't just have great diversity at, you know, sort of junior to mid manager level of the organization and then have zero diversity with everybody that is the same, looks the same, you know, have the same norms, same biases at senior levels, because that's where strategic decisions take place. That's where organizational decisions take place. And so you need that representation. And so I would say a key focus is to make sure that there is representation throughout your organization and purposely driven where the opportunity arises and it's time to, you know, to rehire, focus on screening in, pulling through, sourcing in diversity that increases and diversifies the representation in your business. But I love what you say about the younger generation. You know, this has been much of a conversation between me and my friends as well, because the generation now are not, I think there's a couple of things. One, they're just not taking it, right? I think I'm in my 40s. I say that, you know, I don't look it, I'd like to think. But I'm in my 40s and I'm of first immigrant parents into the UK. And we were kind of told, my mum bucked the trend actually, but the majority of the rest of my family, my cousins, we were all told to keep your head down, keep quiet, fit in, don't speak out, just get what you have to get on, be polite. We were always told to keep quiet. And when I speak to my friends who are from an Asian background, they're told the same things, right? Mm-hmm. We were invited here. Don't speak out. Don't be rude. Don't be too bossy. We were told what not to do and to conform and to fit in and to allow people for the mistakes and the microaggressions. You know, it's almost as if our parents and grandparents came and thought, well, he's just called me this racist name, but well, he didn't mean it because he's not really seen someone like me before. Well, that's not okay. I say he, she, you know, whoever. It's not okay. So I think what we see with this generation coming up now is just so exciting. Why? One, because they're more diverse. You know, I cannot wait for the Census 2021 report to come out, because what was diversity in 2011? I'm just sitting back, you know, because a lot of the work that I do quite a lot of statistical analysis and research, because you need data, right? You need evidence sometimes. And when you look at the diversity data of 2011, you know, when you look at the numbers in the UK, you know, 7.5% Black, Asian, ethnic minority population, of which 1.3% is British Caribbean, et cetera, et cetera. That is going to change significantly. So this new generation have got a huge amount of diversity. They've been raised in diversity. It's the norm. They see diverse mix of people. They're activists. They just won't accept the nonsense that we were told to accept. And I think it's fair to say that our narrative now, as the parents or the aunts or the godparents or the neighbor, our narrative has changed too. Mm-hmm. Because when I see young individuals who, you know, remind me of myself, I celebrate them when I see them doing what I didn't dare to do. You know, some of the passing privileges that I happen to come across and the way I would conform to fit in with straightening my hair or wearing certain clothes, that I am celebrating them. So, and applauding them to go on and supporting the journey, right? As well as conforming to it myself. So I actually see this younger generation coming in as ones that me, certainly in my generation, should now aspire to shadow and to copy almost a little, because they are really making some changes. So it's exciting. They're change makers, right?
They are real change makers. I'm very excited to see how, yes, definitely the reports from the census. And I guess for me, I'm curious to see how we can invite more of that activism into the organization and harness it in a way that's informative. You know, a lot of the work that I do, I think HR are like, we're really worried about a younger generation. They're either not coping very well from the isolation and, you know, mental health concerns. And I worry that their voices are often lost in the process because they are struggling with other mental health issues too. And so how does a company kind of really harness those voices without, I guess, rocking the boat too much? Or maybe they do need to rock the boat too much.
Yeah. But
how do we embrace that in the company versus seeing that as this is a disruption of the status quo, which we were happy with?
That kind of sigh was, for me, it's like, well, how do we harness those voices? Well, first give them a voice. You know, when I...
You think that, you know, a friend of mine runs the kind of BAME group in his company, and he says, we're all so passionate about this, but everyone at the meeting is Black, Asian, and there isn't the people with the power who coming to those meetings.
Yeah, so this is where there is this need. There has to be change at senior levels. There has to be an ally in there on senior levels. And those organizations who truly want to make change, you'll see them making that change of representation. And as strong Black, Asian, ethnic minority candidates or employees in an organization, let's just remember, right, that organizations deliver and have great products and have great innovation and have customers who keep coming back because of what an organization's outputs are, what they deliver. And that comes through their people. If you are a performing, high performing employee in an organization that is doing your bit well, that is contributing to the success of that organization, and they are continuously refusing to represent you, why are you staying? Mm. And it's so easy for me to say that, right? But actually, I've been in organizations before, and I worked my way up, worked incredibly hard, saw the work that I was doing and how it would contribute directly to an individual or directly to that organization. And then, I'd give them maybe one or two chances to be able to prove my worth back to me, to recognize me, reward me for the work that I was doing. I've never left an organization on negative, in a negative graph, and I've always been asked to return. But the moment that I can see that they are not going to reward me for the work that I'm going to do or recognize me and my contribution, I would leave. Mm-hmm. So am I saying that we should all get up and leave? Maybe I kind of am, actually, because we all know I'm disruptive. Yes, I am a little. You're talented. You're delivering for that organization. You're making that change. They give you a voice. We're hearing, potentially. They give you that voice because they create the environment. They create the space for you to have that voice and have that room. But they're not making the change. Actually, then perhaps you should look for the organization that does. And there are organizations out there that do. And don't get me wrong. I think every organization that I work with or I observe who are doing well, they're still learning. There is so much for them to unlearn and learn on the journey because they're still not there yet. But there are those who have more humility in that learning journey, right? Mm. And are open to recognizing where there's wrong. I was speaking to a white CEO leader recently who I coach, and the conversation he had to me was, I need to know when it's time for me to go. I now need to make sure that I step to the side so that somebody else can step in, and I know it's my responsibility to do that, right? Mm-hmm. At the right time. It's that kind of powerful allyship that you need. And if you haven't got leaders in your organization that recognize that it's time to increase representation by bringing in someone of a different race, religion, gender, ability, sexuality. If you don't have individuals in your organization who know that, then perhaps it's time to go, because you can't be who you can't see, right? And if you can't see yourself at that senior level in the organization and you're delivering everything that you can in your talent to that organization, well, maybe they don't recognize you and appreciate you for who you are. So go where you can see who you can be.
How do we start to help managers have these conversations with their team? Like, how do you start to, you say that you're coaching the CEO, like how do you encourage them to have these richer conversations with their senior leaders? Or, what language do we need to start using to approach these conversations and make them part of the everyday versus the hot potato topic?
I think with some individuals, some organizations, it's always going to be the hot potato, right? But nothing easy comes with comfort. Mm-hmm. I need to lose 20 pounds, Sam, and I'm really uncomfortable because it means I'm going to have to stop eating bread the way that mm-hmm. I want to eat bread. Mm-hmm. And that makes me sit in discomfort. But if I want to lose the 20 pounds, and you know what, I'm not minimizing it by sort of talking about carbohydrates and my waistline, but the fact is that the hot potato, how do we make these conversations easier? We can't. This is an uncomfortable topic for some individuals, and they need to sit in that discomfort. They need to be aware of their bias. They need to be aware of their privilege and how they show up in society. We need to be aware that the systems, processes, procedures for organizations were written by the majority group and benefit the majority group, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to recognize that the majority group will probably have some discomfort with those conversations. So we could tiptoe around the subject, but you know, tiptoeing around the subject's not going to get us there. I do agree that with some, you know, I was going to say with some individuals, you need to go at it a different way. But I say that, but I don't think I agree with my, I don't agree, actually. I understand that there's some individuals who can only hear it if it's spoken by certain individuals, right? Or if it's put in a certain way. So whilst I acknowledge that, I'm not, certainly not that person. And that doesn't mean I come at organizations or individuals at a sledgehammer, and anyone who works with me will echo that. You know, that's certainly not the way I believe in supporting people through a learning and an unlearning journey. I don't believe in a sledgehammer approach. It doesn't work. But I recognize that some people just won't hear that from me, and they need to hear it from others. So it's either building the allies around who will be listened to, who will be heard, and letting them go in to make the change and make the journey, or recognizing that you're going to have to start that conversation and that there will be some discomfort. And that conversation should be started by those who are not triggered by having those conversations, right? It takes a certain amount of gusto to not be triggered and have trauma from having conversations with individuals who completely deny the trauma that individuals go through. And there are many people in our society who do that. So, yeah, I think it's just one, acknowledging there's going to be discomfort and it is a hot potato. So let's face it as it is. Mm-hmm. Two, not triggering yourself in order to do that. Three, make sure there are allies. Those allies should be doing that. And we all know what allyship is. And if you don't, we should start reading about allyship, because it's our responsibility to ally for others. And hopefully that starts to make the change. And my key thing, and I've probably been saying this for quite a few years actually, but if all of that's not happening, or if that happens and there's not going to be any change, then put yourself first and walk out. And I don't mean walk away from a job and put your rent and mortgage and family at risk. What I'm saying is you are in control of your own life, right? To your very own words, Sam, love it mm-hmm. or leave it. Mm-hmm. Why give people the best of you that turns huge profit or, you know, mobilizes huge change for their organizations if they don't recognize, include, reward or support you in your authentic self? They can walk up, you go away from that.
Yeah.
Miss me with that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Miss me with that. I wonder, could you share any examples of companies that are doing things well, or at least some initiatives that you think are working currently?
Oh, what companies are doing well? I don't know if I want to put,
if you don't want to label them, but like what kinds of things are they putting in place that, and they're seeing the changes that you think are positive or moving them in the positive direction?
Yeah, that I'll do. And that's not because I don't want to name organizations, but actually there are some that on the surface looks like they're doing great, but I don't know what it's like inside, right? But there are many organizations that I work with and I know they're doing great things inside, but sometimes it's not what you hear and see. You know, you can see all this sparkly stuff, but actually inside, employees are having horrendous experiences through their employee cycle. So what types of things have I seen or recommended that make a change? You referred to it a little earlier actually, which is be really clear about what your employees' experience is. Make the space, time, and make space, time, and availability to hear your employees' voice, and do that for them in a way that they're psychologically safe, right? Don't put the CEO in a room with a group of women and say, you know, tell me a little bit about how your experiences are. They're probably not going to be psychologically safe in that environment, and they're not going to want to speak about it there. So create environments that is, you know, within their working day, so it's not their personal time, to give them psychological safety to be able to use their voice to either gain support and camaraderie from other colleagues where they need it, but also to be able to share where things could improve and make sure that there is a tool or a vehicle available for them to share that, which again is anonymized or keeps their psychological safety. So that's one big thing that I would say. organizations who are doing really well have approached this with absolute humility. So they have not gone in there saying, well, we'll look at this area, but we won't look at that. Or yes, that we see those findings, but I don't want you to use the word racist. You know, they've gone in it with complete humility and openness in the analysis of what's happening in their organizations, and then accept where there is the findings, right? Where there's findings that there are systemic failures, there are systemic issues that have caused bias, that there has been racism in the workplace that has stopped progressions of certain employees, that employees from an Asian background or a Black background or a trans background have felt invisible or not supported or are not progressing past certain levels. There has to be humility in accepting that this is the true experience, and that it can't be just evidenced away or explained away, because no excuses, right? So that those are two really good things that I've seen. And I think the other, in that humility as well, I just want to add to that, in that humility, I think it's important to also recognize that this is going to take time. This is not going to be fixed overnight. And these quick wins, some of these quick wins are important. So to have the dialogue, to start the education are important, but there is some, you know, if you're an organization that's been running for the last 400 years, you've been behaving in this way, this systemic issues with process, policies and procedures has been in place for the last 400 years. And you do not have 400 years to fix it, but be aware that the likelihood is that you're not going to fix it in the next 6 months. So build an appropriate EDI strategy and build it to be change making and stretching and striving for justice across your organization. Prioritize so that it works and starts impacting on people immediately, and make sure everybody is aware of it. You know, be really vocal about what that strategy is, what you're trying to change, why it's taking so long, and what some of the failings are. So there's a lot about that transparency, that humility, that willingness to change, and giving the employees the safety of a voice to be able to go back and say, this didn't work, this worked, because it's a journey that everybody needs to go on together.
Yeah, I agree totally. And what do you think about, or how do we start to really weave in technology into this as well, and make sure that the recruitment that we're doing or the AI that we might be using to recruit candidates is not, you know, leaning into the bias? How do we make sure that this, all these practices kind of work efficiently remotely, or if we're a hybrid company, how do we kind of make allowances for this?
I mean technology, AI, you know, I'm a fan of it because I enjoy it, I use it often. But the fact is, these systems, this technology, these AIs, that the bias is built in. Who's building the system? Right? So if the person building the system, if there's no representation in the individuals building the systems, building the technology, I can guarantee you, no matter how much they're trying, there is going to be bias in that system. You know, I have quite a lot of arguments about this, because I've had people really challenge me because I say, I don't agree with blind CVs. I don't, full stop. And I've had people say to me, of course we should have blind CVs. And this is not technology, but it's an example. There are platforms built for blind CVs, right? There are platforms built to strip and remove any form of evidence about anybody in order to ensure bias can't take place. And this is an example of technology, right? And the reason why I'm so against it is twofold. One, the moment you blind my CV, right, the moment you strip out my gender, the university that I went to, the education that I got, my name, you're stripping out everything. Why should I have to strip my whole identity to make sure you're not racist towards me? I mean, why are we doing that? So what you're trying to do is you're minimizing me to fix the problem. The problem is that hiring manager or that recruitment manager who is biased or who is racist, right? Fix the problem. Stop minimizing me and how I show up in the world. So in my family, I was the first person to achieve a degree, and I achieved a degree it wasn't Russell Group and it wasn't the most well-known university, but that was me. I paid for it myself. I was the only one to do it. My family were incredibly proud of it. So why should that be stripped away from me? Now, because I'm from a West Indian background, we have got fairly English sounding names. But if I was from an African background, and let's face it, I am somewhere in history, I'm from an African background. So you're stripping me of what is my cultural heritage, that beautiful name that defines which part of the continent I come from. You're removing that for me because of the bias of the hiring manager. So my thing is, how do we use AI and technology? Unless you're going to have more representation in who is building that technology, who is building those systems, who is creating it, one, there's always going to be bias in it anyway. And two, from my perspective, you're just delaying the bias, because the problem is either the hiring manager who has that bias, or you're delaying it because if someone happens to get through that process because you've used all of this great technology that's stripped them of their individuality, they'll show up in the workplace on the first day, or they'll show up in the interview, and that same hiring manager who has a affinity bias to someone who went to the same university as him or her or them is going to choose that person anyway. So we're doing all of that for nothing. So I'm a big focus on fixing the people. Fix the problem. That would be my view.
And so when you think about, you know, everything that you're doing involves such a leaning into the emotional kind of journey, whether or not it's on the manager or leader side, but you're also hearing the plight of the employee. How do you look after yourself in this journey and in the work that you're doing? How do you maintain your sanity and kind of your work happiness?
How do I maintain? Well, there's one, I have got the fiercest group of girlfriends around me. I mean, my friends, my circle of friends, I've known them for probably since I've been 19, and so I've got a huge amount of safety around me where I can come into this environment and listen to individuals who are just point blank refusing that there are disparities, and walk out of this environment and pick up a phone or walk into a friend zone and be fully supported. So I have a fantastic unit around me to include amazing friends. You know, we've known each other since we were 19, a sort of a core group of about 6 or 7 of us. But I also have I'm very, very lucky to have a wonderful family unit, 2 sisters, very, very close to me. So I'm very safe at home. I'm very safe, you know, in the world, in the friends around me. But I also surround myself with people in my work environment that's safe, right? I make sure that everyone in our organization agrees with the end goal, right? So we might not always agree. We may have disagreements, and so we should. There should be healthy challenge in organizations about where others, you know, where from different perspectives. And I'm lucky enough to have an organization with a huge amount of diversity. I mean, we have diversity of race, we have diversity of religion, we have diversity of ability, we have diversity of gender, we have diversity of sexuality. We have a huge amount of diversity in our organization. So we've got perspectives from everywhere. And it's wonderful to go into those conversations with the team and know that we have all of those different perspectives, and therefore we'll challenge each other's thinking. And I've been held accountable a few times, and so I should be. So it's great to have that. But at the end of the day, we're all working to this same goal, right? To this equitable environment, to this justice where we can all go into a workplace and feel included and feel like we belong. We all were in our authentic self. We all work to that. And that helps me. And then, so I've got safety in my environment at work, safety in my environment at home. But I also know, I mean, my sister will ignore, she'll listen to this and talk, but I also know when to check out. Like, I'm checking out after today. So I am going to turn off my phones, drive up 2.5 hours up. Up through England, because I'm allowed now, or I will be allowed in a couple of days. So when it's allowed, by the way, and I'm going to,
you know, walk into a little lodge and close the door and I'm checking out. So there really is, it's important to have that safety around you, but also to know when it's time to stop and just do some self-care. And I'm not the best at that, to be honest, because I am, you know, I'm a bit of a workaholic. I've always worked. I enjoy work. It's not something that I find strenuous, and I like sort of high demanding environments. I've always been like that, but I do know when to stop.
And do you encourage this with some of the, I mean, do you work in partnership with HR and companies as well? And are you able to encourage them to know when to rest as well?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if but my background is HR, right? So that was my degree. That's what I've studied. That's what I've delivered for the last 15 years. My background's HR, good knowledge of employment law, L&D, and of course, EDI. So I think it's rare that you find practitioners, and I am a practitioner, I'm a fellow of the CIPD, that has all of that mixture. And I've been in that many environments that I've been able to really immerse myself in all of those areas. I've been quite lucky in my learning. So when I talk to fellow HR practitioners, fellow HR leaders, because I'm either supporting them as a, you know, as a silent leader on the side with them, or because they've asked me to come in and support them to create their HR or EDI strategies, I always do have that check-in moment with them, because I've been a practitioner myself. I delivered a training session yesterday, actually, to a group of probably about 12 HR business partners and managers in an organization who are about to embark on a program of change, and just, you know, had to sort of reignite and remember that intersectional and inclusion lens that must be applied before you go into sort of change in an organization. And they, I could, you know, part of that conversation was making sure that they remembered to always put the intersectional and inclusion perspective first. When they're about to embark on that change, but it's also to make sure they understand as HR practitioners that they need to be really mindful and aware of themselves, because how they show up in that role, right? If as a HR practitioner myself, I was responsible for the recruitment of hundreds of people, I was responsible for the well-being journey of hundreds, if not thousands of people in an organization. I was responsible for creating processes to making decisions on performance, on pay, on reward. You are such a significant tool, you're such a significant influence in that organization that you have to be aware of your wellness and your being, because the things that we do impact on the people, right? Yes. And if you're impacting on people in the organization, you have to be looking after yourself as well. So yeah, it is significant, and I really do follow it up, because every time I'm with a fellow HR leader, I'm remembering my own journey as a leader and the experiences I went through, so I can really relate to it a lot of the time.
Oh, well, I think, you know, I love the fact that you have that grounding as well and can support them to be better for themselves first, to ripple out and continue to create change for others, because if we don't, it's... they're going to be so depleted that, you know, all the magic they want to create is just not going to be possible.
Exactly.
That's the ethos that I'm really trying to put out into the world as change makers, is that, you know, there's a nourishment that you provide to yourself, whether that is through your support system, through your own personal practices, that really do serve to the betterment of others in the long term.
I agree. And I've never thought, you know, I love the way you've described it, that nourishment to yourself. I've never really thought of it in that way, because when you think about the word nourishing, it's sort of replenishing, feeding, you know, everything to do with growth is nourishment, right? And I've never considered it like that. I've always thought, well, look after yourself and well-being. But I think I'm going to adopt that phrase for myself now, that nourishment of self is critical, especially if your responsibility nourishes others, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, I loved talking to you today. I think we could go on and on and on, but I am conscious that you also need to go back and do some work. What would be your top three takeaways for a company, whether it is an organizational leader or even just a manager who is thinking, you know, I'm going back into work on Monday and my team is quite diverse, but we've not been having those raw conversations, or I want to show that I'm ready to do this work on a deeper level, what would you suggest?
Oh, what would I suggest? Top three. Be prepared to learn and unlearn. Mm. A lot of people are learning, right?
Yeah.
They're doing a load of learning. They're reading. There's some formidable books out there, some fantastic influences for us to listen to and to watch and to understand. Do the unlearning too. There's no point in layering on learning onto behaviors that you have that you haven't taken responsibility for. Mm-hmm. And that could be about narratives passed down to you when you were growing up, the biases that you have, right? Biases are both favorable and unfavorable, right? The biases that you have that you refuse to accept actually could impact on someone's future. So do the unlearning as well as the learning would be one of my tips.
Mm-hmm.
A second thing, and this is probably relative to very much now, right? But a second thing is, don't be under the impression that this is gonna go away.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I mean, we've had this, the murder of George Floyd last year in May has, you know, a lot of people are saying it's a resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. There's a huge focus now on inclusion and the impact of Black people in the workplace and in organizations. This was always there, and it's not going to go away, and it's time to do something about it, right? And employees are currently constantly being triggered, constantly. If they haven't been triggered by the murder of George Floyd and how you reacted to it last year, if they're women, they've been triggered by the murder of Sarah Everard. Yeah. If they're Black, they're going to be triggered again because of the trial that's happening with the murderers of George Floyd. They're going to be triggered in May when it happens because we're going to be reminded of somebody who, you know, looks like one of your family members being killed in broad daylight by someone who's meant to serve and protect them. Mm-hmm. The triggering is happening in the workplace on a day-to-day basis from individuals with different intersectional experiences. So this is not going to go away. We're going to become more diverse as a world and as a society. And it's our responsibility to ensure that we understand that everybody has the right to belong and feel included in this society, which includes that workplace. And, you know, the more society diversifies, the more the customer base will diversify. It's time. It's there's no more time for talking. So, God, I went off on a rant there, but
I love it.
I do.
Passionate.
Because it's, you know, it's almost a demand now. I'm at that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I'm at the top, right? I've done all the hygiene factors. I've done all the learning. I peaked in my career and did really well. Now I'm demanding this. I've had a child. I've got nieces. I'm demanding that there's some change. I am not, why am I having the same conversation? Why are individuals facing the same plights? Why are we experiencing the same thing? Look at the trigger that happened with women recently. How many women, you know, over the last month have been thinking about a near miss or that time in the workplace or when that happened to me? It's too many times of repetitive behavior. So learn and unlearn was my one. Number two was my rant, but you know, this sort of don't think this is going away. And people are being triggered. So those are my sort of, I think those are my maybe one, two, and three, because I'm ranting. No, actually, I'm going to give a 30, 40 is what I'm going to call it. It is your responsibility. Because everybody's like, well, such and such, or well, this is in my way, or well, if it wasn't, because it is your responsibility. It's our responsibility to be the change that we want to see. And it sounds so cliche, and it's not my statement. I didn't create that, obviously, but we have to be the change we want to see. So yes, it is your responsibility, the little cog in the wheel of that work environment. It is your responsibility to make that change, especially in our sometimes already thankless departments of human resources, where we look after our people. We are there for the people of the organization as well as the business, and it's our responsibility to make sure that the two connect, and that our people are included and have well-being and feel great to come to our places of work, and that we give them that environment where they can authentically show up.
Love that. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. I really appreciated it.
You're welcome.
Can we find out more about you and the work that you do?
Well, next week you can't find out about me at all because I'm going to drop off the radar. But actually, I do have a great team. You can find out about our services on our website. It's www.inclusiverecruiting.co.uk. Call the team. It tells you a lot about us, our three pillars of work, the HR services that we deliver. You can find out all about us there.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much to you too. I really value it. And now I'm going to spend the rest of the day saying to everybody, I'm a change maker. I mean, I don't believe it, but I'm a change maker because Sam said I am.
You are a change maker. You own it.
Thank you.
Hello, hello. Well, what another fantastic episode. Thank you so much for carving out the time to hang out with us and hear everything that was shared today on our podcast. If you are interested in becoming a changemaker and something has piqued your interest and you want to either revamp your own ways of looking at your well-being as you lead a team through change, or maybe you want to create deeper interventions in your company that are going to stick and that people care about actually using, why not join our Changemaker Certification? This is our roadmap to helping you go through our three areas of change: becoming a better change maker, empowering and inspiring others to do the same, and amplifying the message that you have created. Check out all the details of our Changemaker certification on loveitleaveit.co, and I cannot wait to get started with you. See you soon for another amazing episode. Bye for now.